Classical audience has gone wild. Welcome to Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the next hour, we'll hear how pianists test the limits of virtuosity, and we'll have some live music, virtuoso or otherwise, from the jazz pianist and composer Omer Klein. But we begin by looking at the audience getting so caught up in a live piece of music that it would applaud and cheer after each piece. Is this a rock concert? No, it's Frédéric Chopin playing this piece of seven variations. Sometimes the audience would even clap while the music was going on, and Chopin then might start to improvise and work the crowd like a Vegas performer. Nowadays, such behavior in a classical concert would be unthinkable. But should it be? In a new book called After the Golden Age, author and pianist himself, Kenneth Hamilton, explores how classical concerts have turned into such solemn, often routine affairs, and he suggests what needs to change. Ken Hamilton joins us today from the studios of the BBC in London. Ken, thank you for being with us.
Hello there.
So performers and audiences often express a kind of wistful nostalgia for the good old days, you know, the golden age when performers treated scores more literally and concerts were more respectful and more dignified. You say that's a fallacy, right?
It's a complete fiction. and in fact, the amazing thing, it's a fiction partly promoted by the music world. I basically wrote this book because as a performer myself, one begins to lose sight to some extent of the audience experience. And I was at a particularly awful concert that seemed to be, but given by somebody else, thank goodness, that seemed to be modeled after the etiquette of a funeral, effectively. And the audience sat there in solemn silence. They were obviously terrified to make any noise at all or clap or anything. And in fact, they had been told beforehand by somebody coming on stage that they were not allowed to make any noise, otherwise the performer would collapse or whatever. I don't know. As a performer myself, I can't understand why this is so dangerous. But anyway, and I thought to myself, well, a lot of people nowadays seem to think that this was the sort of concert that existed when this music was written, and it's simply not true. In other words, we perform this music in a scenario, in a set of circumstances and etiquettes that simply did not exist in the days of Beethoven, Liszt, Chopin, even later into the 19th century. I'm afraid that this sort of concert world is ours and ours alone.
Well, now, how has that happened? I mean, where did this obsession with this fictional tradition come from?
Well, it's probably got a number of reasons. One of them is certainly the growth of the standard repertoire. You have to remember that in the early 19th century, most concerts played new music. You know, it was contemporary music. When you played Beethoven, Beethoven was still alive. When you played Schumann, Schumann was still alive. But gradually, a standard repertoire grew up for various reasons that people have suggested why, but nobody is entirely sure. And so there are these sort of sacred masterworks of music, the Beethoven piano sonatas, the Chopin ballads, whatever. And these things gradually begin to be listened to like museum pieces, like you go to an art gallery and see a wonderful painting. So they're not live in a certain sense anymore. They're not new, contemporary, modern. They're sort of things you ought to admire. And even worse, if you're educated, you ought to know them. And this is the really worrying thing. And as soon as it gets to that stage, the music becomes, as I say, a museum piece more than a live experience.
And it becomes something that is not welcoming to people who don't know it.
Well, this is the real problem. I mean, the problem isn't that people nowadays listen in silence. I mean, I, as a player myself, don't want people yelling in the middle of something, you know, naturally enough. Except, oddly enough, a piece like a Liszt Hungarian Rhapsody was certainly written for people to be yelling in the middle. I mean, if Liszt had played that and nobody had made any noise, he would have thought it was a disaster. He would have wondered what had gone wrong. So the etiquette has changed completely.
Well, we're speaking with Kenneth Hamilton, pianist and author of the book After the Golden Age, Romantic Pianism and Modern Performance. Modern performance is really what we're talking about here, where you, as you say, Ken, there's this feeling like you can't make noise.
You can't.
You're afraid to applaud when the music ends because you're just not sure. Is the piece over? Is it just a movement? Will I seem gauche if I applaud here?
Exactly. It's a sort of test of manners or education. And the dreadful thing now is if people applaud because they want to applaud, because they like the music, and at the wrong place, they'll then be hushed by somebody next to who's obviously better educated. And when I was writing this book, I thought, well, am I imagining this? Maybe just because, you know, you go to one or two really awful concerts, it's not all all like that. But then I read on the internet that an American conductor had turned to an audience somewhere, I can't remember where, just about a year ago, and told them that they could not possibly applaud after the second last movement of Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony. This would be dreadful and ill-mannered and insensitive. And let me tell you, there is no way in the world that this could not have been what Tchaikovsky expected. There was no possible performance circumstance in Tchaikovsky's day when this couldn't have happened. So in fact, it was the conductor telling the audience how ignorant they were going to be. It was the conductor who was ignorant. This is the irony.
So in Tchaikovsky's day, and even before Tchaikovsky, looking at, Chopin, Beethoven, I mean, a symphony premiered then, you might have to, as a conductor, you might have to be ready to play that first movement, if it went over well, like three times before you ever got to the second movement.
It could be encored. Different bits could be encored. The fact is that the example you gave at the beginning of your program there, the Chopin variations and La Tue d'Arême, that now each one of these variations would have been expected to receive applause. And not only that, Chopin wrote a particularly dull and boring orchestral interlude between the variations, which you're not meant to listen to. It's really just a cover the applause, and it's awful, you know. And in fact, he even says, if you play this piece as a piano solo, don't play this orchestral interlude, it's simply too awful, you know. So we don't realize this nowadays. We just think, what a very boring 10 bars there, I wonder why they're there.
Wow, so he actually had little placeholders built in.
Like a
speechwriter will write an applause line. And
yes, exactly. It's the musical equivalent of the auto cue, sort of look up for applause sort of thing. It's exactly that sort of. But of course, because we don't have this concert etiquette nowadays, we don't know this. Likewise with the Tchaikovsky exam, if a composer in the 18th or 19th century writes a whole load of big loud chords at the end, boom, boom, bang, 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 and then stops, he expects the audience to applaud. There is no great subtlety here, that there's no enormous sophistication where, you know, composers wrote these things in order to get the obvious response, not to show how bright and educated the audience was, that, you know, that, oh, wait a minute, I know there's a slow movement coming, so I won't applaud. This did not happen.
So in the case of the composer Rubinstein, for example, his Piano Concerto No. 4, which the great Josef Hoffmann recorded back in 1937, so we're into, you know, pretty far into the 20th century. But you can still hear, even at this late date, the audience responding to what is clearly a call for applause. And this is not at the end of the piece. This is at the end of the first movement. Let's listen to a little bit, Josef Hoffmann playing Rubinstein. Now remember, that's not the end of the piece. That's just the end of the first movement. So Ken, this is like the screaming guitar solo. And you know, the crowd then going wild afterwards.
Exactly. You know, there's all this thing in evolutionary theory. Did dinosaurs die out or did they evolve into birds? Well, you know, the old style of classical concert just evolved into the jazz or pop concert. And the audiences react now almost exactly that way in a jazz concert as they would have in a 19th century or 18th century public concert. But you know, the example is a good one there because that is the late 1930s. This sort of etiquette carried on much, much later than people think. If you ask music students, you know, when did people stop applauding, a lot of them probably say mid-19th century. Even a lot of music academics seem to think this. But in fact, you know, it's well within living memory. You know, there must be quite a lot of old guys around that can remember a time, you know, when people normally applauded.
We're speaking with Kenneth Hamilton, the pianist and author of the book After the Golden Age, looking at what has happened to concert behavior, especially in the classical concert hall. And we'd like you to weigh in. Do you prefer silence at a classical performance? Would you find applause at the end of each variation in a piece disruptive? What would you change about the concert experience if you could? Give us a call at 212-264-7483. That's 212-264-7483. Or leave a comment on the Soundcheck page of our website, wnyc.org. Ken, in researching this book, you had a fair amount, actually, a surprising amount, of source material to go to, including concert programs from the 19th century. Yeah. Tell us what you found about how concerts were constructed back then.
Well, I mean, there's a much higher role, at least before 1850, a much, much higher role given to improvisation. And this is also connects up with, you know, classical concerts had more relation with jazz concerts in the old days, if you like. I mean, basically, people before about 1850 or 60 didn't play, if you're a solo piano player, the music from memory. That, in other words, written music, if you were going to play a piece by Chopin, you often had the music in front of you. But the bits that you didn't have the music for were your own improvisations. You know, I mean, it, rather like a cocktail bar piano player these days will take requests from the audience, you know, people like Liszt or whoever would actually take requests for popular tunes that they would then improvise on. Just like when I was a student and I used to play in lounge bars and somebody said, can you do some Enchanted Evening? I would do some Enchanted Evening. It was as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. And the Chopin preludes, what would those have been preludes to?
Well, this is an interesting, often nowadays piano students don't think, you know, why should anybody have written 24 little pieces called preludes with nothing after them, you know, except another prelude. But in fact, just like again, in a cocktail bar, we don't play show tunes one after another. We do little links in between them, little preludes and links. And if I've been employed to spend an hour, you know, entertaining the customers, I play little links from one tune to another. This is what they did with classical music. You played a prelude before a piece and often a transition link to the next piece. So you would take your applause and then you would maybe play a little bit of the previous piece or a theme and then work into the next piece. Exactly. I mean, it really is exactly like cocktail music today. Quite astonishing, really.
I'm not sure I like the idea of going to a big, long cocktail piano recital, though. You know, if I'm going to a classical concert, I mean, I do want to hear something of a different order, you know what I mean?
Yes. I mean, you don't have to like this. The whether you like it or not is, in a way, another question. If you prefer concert giving us as it is today, then that's fine. This is purely a matter of taste. And there's lots of things that are good about concert giving today. The point is that most people don't even realize that things were not like this. I think this is the point. In other words, there isn't the choice anymore. We just assume that classical concerts were always like that. Now, I've played some of these preludes that you know, sometimes these improvised preludes were eventually written down, and I've played them, you know, to music students and things, and they laugh nowadays. People burst into laughter if you do a transition into a Beethoven sonata, because it sounds like a different world. It sounds like the world of the lounge bar has suddenly come into the classical concert hall.
Well, so what happened to, I mean, why did pianists stop doing little improvised mini preludes or cadenzas before they actually launched into the piece itself?
It's difficult to tell exactly, and this is very, very late. I mean, people were still preluding again up to the 1940s. Like Josef Hoffmann, and that concert that you just gave the example of, he preludes a little bit between his solo numbers, you know, and so if you don't know the piece, you think it's a bit of the piece, but it isn't. It's a bit of Josef Hoffmann. Mm-hmm. So why did they change? Well, the possible reasons, perhaps one is recording. I mean, the concert etiquette and the way people played things began to sound more like the way people heard things on recordings. Now, remember, old recordings, you could only record 4.5 minutes at a time. You had a very limited side length, and people didn't have, you know, time to waste playing little improvised transitions. So you got the piece, and that was it. I mean, you were lucky to get the piece on, more than several sides.
Also, if you had a concert audience, which consisted of a family sitting in front of the Victrola in their living room, you didn't need a prelude to cover the sound of people settling in their chairs or anything like that. You could get right into it.
No, naturally enough. The funny thing is, though, the preludes didn't just, you know, cover the noise, although they certainly did that, but the preludes also, you know, added a bit of the performer's own thoughts into the music. In other words, it was more a question of, this is the performer, he's doing a little bit of improvisation, he's also playing some repertoire stuff, and, you know, basically the performer has more input as a creative artist in that sort of way. And all these guys, all these piano players in the 19th century thought of themselves basically as composers as well as performers. That's the main thing.
All right, let's see what some of our Soundcheck listeners have to say about all of this, and we'll see if we can get two different points of view at the same time. David joining us from Queens, and also joining us is... it looks like I hit a wrong button. So we'll start with just David in Queens. David, what's your take on all of this?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was sitting at a concert with Radulupu and Riccardo Muti last week, having the same exact fantasy that you're talking about, that I should be able to applaud and cheer when it was exciting, when it moved me, and you know, thinking back to maybe like a sports event almost. Tennis used to be very quiet and restrained, and it's not anymore, and I think it's improved. I think that it was very off-putting for me in school when I was told to behave at a concert as if it was a funeral. Music does move you. That's part of what it does, and showing it appropriately is a way of letting the feelings show and communicating with the artist that, boy, I really like what you're doing. So I think it's a good idea.
I love the image of the sporting event, but, David, I think the word that really leaps out at me is music moves you. And mm-hmm. Ken, it sounds like in the real golden age in the 19th century, mm-hmm. if the music moved you, you could move. I mean, you could express that somehow.
Sure. And the funny thing is, you know, as late as about in the mid-1940s, that the great and then very elderly concert pianist Moritz Rosenthal wrote something, an article complaining about people stopping applauding. And he said, you know, this is terribly dispiriting for the artist. And basically, if you're moved by the music, he said, if your heart tells you to applaud, applause. Give the applause. And he ended his little article, so it said, basically the rule is follow your heart if you have one. That's what he said.
Nice. Christina joining us from right here in Manhattan. Christina, I understand you're a pianist yourself?
Yes, I am. And, you know, I had an experience. I had a recital at Manus College, actually, where I graduated from. And we had to request that the audience stop, not clap in between movements because we were recording. But a terrible thing happened. They got confused and they thought that they should not clap at all, not even at the end of a piece. And it was the most bizarre experience because I thought I was going to cry at the end of the piece when I didn't hear any clapping. I said, they absolutely hate me. And I said, I will never do that again because I really needed to hear their clapping. I needed to hear people saying, ah, yes, or express some kind of delight. It was so bizarre.
Well, but, how would it have been bizarre as well if people had suddenly started clapping, say, halfway through the first movement of one of the pieces you were playing?
I used to think it would, but it depends. You know, if you're playing through a quiet moment and you're trying to create a mood, that would maybe be odd. But if you're doing something that's incredibly virtuosic and it's supposed to be fun, I think I would welcome it. And I think I will start encouraging audiences to participate and, you know, feel free. One thing that disturbs me in New York, however, is I just heard Ratolupu at Carnegie Hall, and he played the Debussy Preludes. And I really, it's very annoying when people are, for example, coughing so loud in between when there's a beautiful moment and it's quiet and you just want to kind of lose yourself in it.
It's fun. It's funny, Christina, that you mentioned the coughing, because here's a comment from one of our Soundcheck listeners on the Soundcheck page of our website. Mark writes, as a classical guitarist, I'm sorry to note that Andres Segovia was quite autocratic about keeping his audience quiet and would reprimand coughers for not staying at home. True, the unamplified classical guitar demands a low level of audience noise, but at least part of it was imposed personality. So I guess, Ken, we come to the question of, you know, what has changed. One thing that has changed is the size of concert halls.
Oh, very much so. And it's very difficult to, you know, get a more intimate atmosphere in a 3,000-seater hall. There's no doubt about it. But the funny thing was that your last caller there and her experience with, you know, the audience not applauding even when she wanted them to, that this actually happened to Richard Wagner in the first performance of his, you know, this great opera Parsifal. And this was one of the beginnings of the no applause thing. And he told everybody that Parsifal was so solemn, so wonderful, so great, so transcendental that, you know, applause would be a sacrilege. So they played Act One of Parsifal, and of course Wagner's nervous. It's the first night in Bayreuth, and he hears nothing. The chords of the piece end. He hears nothing, and he turns to his wife and says, "What's wrong? Why are they not clapping? Why are they not clapping?" She says, "Well, you told them not to clap," and he went hysterically and said, "I want them to clap! I want them to clap! Tell them to clap!"
The story, as I heard it, was that he actually went back like three different nights telling the audience. The first night he was telling them not to clap. The second night he told them to clap, and he hated that. And then the third night he had some other cockamamie scheme for when people could clap. So
yes, if you read Cosima's diaries, one of these times he went hysterical. It was just a sort of sudden lack of confidence that if they're not clapping, they must hate it, you know?
What about, there is precious little improvisation done by classical pianists these days. If you're going to play Mendelssohn's Fantasia on the Last Rose of Summer, which he probably improvised himself to begin with, you better play the notes that are there in black and white. What's happened to that?
Well, it's basically just a different... It's the old sort of Urtext idea, what the Germans call, you know, the original text, and you're supposed to, you know, do exactly what is in the text. But there's two big problems about this. That sounds like Mendelssohn.
Mendelssohn. Let me just, if we were wrapping up here, so just quickly, you know, it's not just the performers who are kind of straitjacketed, it's us as listeners.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, it's not the kind of thing you can turn back the hands of time to the 19th century, so...
No, but you can sort of know what went on. And if you decide, you know, that the present-day concert world is what you want, then that's fine. But the trouble is that we're sort of deciding this on the basis of thinking it was always like that. And basically, we're deciding on the basis of complete ignorance as to what the alternatives are. And, you know, it's always a good idea to know what you're talking about before you make a decision as to what you actually like.
Kenneth Hamilton is a pianist himself and author of the book After the Golden Age, Romantic Pianism and Modern Performance. Ken, thanks so much for being with us
today. Thank you, a pleasure.
And just ahead, WNYC's Sarah Fischko considers the question of whether piano virtuosity is really all it's cracked up to be. And then later, live music from our piano by composer Omer Klein. He's a rising star of the local jazz scene and mixes jazz with Israeli music and North African root sounds. His trio will play in our studio in just a couple of minutes. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Now, we've just heard that silence in the concert hall is not necessarily a good thing. Well, neither, it turns out, is virtuosity. WNYC's Sarah Fischko investigates why, in the music world, being labeled a virtuoso may not be the highest form of compliment.
When the jazz pianist Oscar Peterson died at the end of 2007, I was struck by the articles and obituaries that appeared in response. Nearly all of the more serious ones framed him as an immensely popular artist, but a controversial one. The controversy concerned his technique and the degree to which it sometimes dominated his playing. The New York Times even compared his career to that of Yasha Heifetz, the celebrated violinist whose image of perfection turned many critics and musicians off his playing. The LA Times cited Peterson's critics, and even Variety noted his hurrahs from impressed odds and the occasional pan from unmoved critics. The pianist himself was dismissive of all that, this from an interview we did in 2000, quoting Igor Stravinsky, of all people.
Stravinsky had the line I like. They asked him about his critics, and purportedly said, "I haven't yet to see a monument to a critic." I think it's a great line. I'll have to use that.
But it's hard not to ponder why the so-called virtuoso in music, or perhaps in any art, might never overcome those critical prejudices. Why is it so hard to be so skilled? I asked Marc-André Hamelin, the highly brilliant classical pianist, whether he had thought of himself as a virtuoso when he began his career, and he answered with one word.
Never.
Hamelin was, early on, referred to by the then New York Times critic Harold Schoenberg as a super virtuoso, largely because of this CD from 1988. It features performances of the Leopold Godowsky transcriptions of Chopin etudes, without doubt some of the most pianistically challenging music in existence. Hamlin recorded it, he says, because his independent record label thought they'd do better in a niche market. And he was thrilled to have been noticed at all by Schoenberg, who was a devotee of this kind of, well, virtuosic playing.
And this review helped me tremendously, of course. But I've come to realize that label was somewhat harmful because of the general public's perception and understanding of what virtuoso means.
Misunderstanding, that is. And not only the public, people in the business, too.
Over time, I have seen concert promoters asking me for these sort of, shall we say, over-athletic repertoire a little too often.
But honestly, it goes even further back than that. Hamlin reports that things began to move in this direction in his student days, just as soon as people discovered his abilities.
I had to wait decades before I was assigned any Schubert.
Schubert having been considered a composer of more serious, less flashy music.
The only Schubert piece that I ever played when I was learning piano at the beginning, you know, was the E-flat major impromptu, Opus 90, number 2. Why? Because it's the one with the running passages.
It's those running passages that provoke the label. Oscar Peterson sure used them a lot. Vladimir Horowitz, another superstar some critics loved to hate, flaunted accuracy in passage work. And speaking of Heifetz, jazz students still look back to the 1950s, holding up a particular Coltrane track called Giant Steps as the standard to emulate, and you can hear why. There are plenty of examples of this driving, spellbinding kind of playing, and singers, of course, can do it too, and it's terrifically entertaining. But there are those that will tell you that's not what virtuosity is. Or at least it is certainly not all that virtuosity is, asserts Marc-André Hamlin.
To achieve a true pianissimo, or a true range of colors, requires a very highly developed control of the instrument, and to me that is also virtuosity.
Vladimir Horowitz's record producer, Thomas Frost, years ago, told me more or less the same thing in trying to describe the gifts of that pianist.
He was able to play independent melodies with those 10 fingers that makes you sound like there are three hands at the piano. The real technique was not the fast and loud playing. It was that type of control.
And Oscar Peterson talked similarly about his idol and then friend and musical influence, Art Tatum.
Forget the command of the instrument. Everyone needs to say, man, boy, can he play the way he'd run up and down that piano. That means nothing. And I don't mean it means nothing, but that isn't that hard to do. But it was the harmonic intent that he had going. The places that he would take these tunes harmonically.
So maybe it's more complicated than it sounds, this whole question of what a virtuoso is. Labels are easy. Being a musician is hard. Marc-André Hamlin, for one, is able now to play more mainstream music, more standard repertoire, such as his Grammy-nominated Haydn CD of last year. Why?
Because I've become more famous. sorry, that's a very crass term.
Just please don't call him a virtuoso if what you mean is a keyboard athlete.
That is why the label, I think, doesn't fit me, unless I know that the person calling me a virtuoso knows fully what it means.
While you're thinking about it, get past the label and listen to the delicious ballad playing of Oscar Peterson. It's part of the picture. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fischko.
Up next on Soundcheck, Omer Klein is capturing the attention of the jazz world with his fluid piano style and mixing of Israeli and North African sounds. That's a kind of virtuosity, too. He'll play live with his trio next on Soundcheck.